This is the story of how a small, dark brown glass bottle of deuterated water changed my life. This is Peter Hill Explains, where I discuss things scientific. The small, almost like bottle of cough mixture, but it was of deuterated water, was on a bench downstairs at Melbourne University when I was an undergraduate, and it was there in a nuclear physics group, and they had a large Fantagraph generator, but without a belt. It's actually pellets, which used to go up and down this Fantagraph generator, which went up to a million volts and fired protons down. This is a single proton, single hydrogen ions, without the actual electrons, down the guts, and it would bend and hit various targets. They had a small bottle there of deuterated water, and when I counted it, it really changed the way I was to approach water in general. So deuterated water is D2O. Instead of H, hydrogen, protons, and oxygen, it's deuterium, which is an isotope of water, hydrogen. We'll discuss how it's made nowadays and its overall properties. So deuterated water requires you to get deuterium, which is an isotope of water, which instead of having a single proton, it's got a proton and a neutron. And how you get protons and neutrons together is quite an easy task. So all you need is a slow neutron. As the neutron slows down, it actually increases in size. It's a hard thing to get your mind around. Its wavelength, de Broglie wavelength, is proportional to its inversely proportional to its momentum. So as it slows down, its actual wavelength increases, cross section increases, and neutrons, free neutrons, will, if they slow down enough and hit some water, will just stick to the water and stick to the actual proton. In fact, neutrons, as I'll discuss a bit later, are these fantastic things that just as they go through, they do either of two things. They either blow up, I think in around 900 seconds at the top of my head, quarter of an hour, something like that, they will, in free space, give up the ghost and emit an electron and convert from a neutron down to a proton. So a neutron or a proton are made up of three quarks. Now, quark is a subcomponent of these fundamental particles of protons and neutrons. And a quark of this matter is an up quark or a down quark. An up quark has a charge of plus 2/3. A down quark has a charge of minus 1/3. So if you have two ups and a down, that's 2/3 plus 2/3 equals 4/3. Minus 1/3 equals 3/3, is a charge of plus 1. Or for a neutron, it's one up and two down. So that's plus 2/3, minus 1/3, minus 1/3, 0. So a neutron is the same as a proton, except one of its quarks is up, the other one's down. And you can actually produce neutrons by a number of processes. One is that you can get a lightish atom and a lightest nucleus and actually smash it to smithereens. And so if you hit, say, a beryllium with an alpha particle, it will absolutely smash apart and producing a shower of neutrons. Now, and there's a whole heap of other ways. You can get uranium and split it. And when you split it in two, it will split up, and in essence, the heavier elements have more and more neutrons. It starts off, it looks as though there's a neutron for every proton, but as it goes on, there's way more neutrons per proton. Uranium has 335 neutrons and protons, there's a vast more number of neutrons than protons. Off the top of my head, I really can't remember the actual number of exact protons and neutrons in uranium. But when it splits apart, it releases a whole series of neutrons and protons. And for this point in time, we don't have to go too much into the quantum mechanics. We can stick with the simple bunch of grapes view of the nucleus. The nucleus is that central little piece of mass inside an atom. And that's the Niels Bohr liquid drop model in 1936. It was only ever proposed and fairly quickly dismissed, but has become the darling of textbooks. The current model for neutrons and protons, so it's more quantum mechanically based, more wave function based, is the Saxon-Woods model, which you go through. It's harder to visualize, but for us, we can just imagine them as two little balls, even though that's not the case. They're not hard little spheres. There's no outer shell or surface of a neutron or proton which would actually keep them apart from each other. They would actually fall into each other with quantum mechanics. So we have a source of neutrons from a nuclear reactor or from a splatteron source. Splatteron source is an alpha particle which fires into beryllium and it breaks it apart, showering it with neutrons. And the neutrons itself will stick to other nuclei. When they slow down, they grow in size, and as they come to rest, before they explode, before they decay, they can actually stick to whole series of nuclei. So neutrons which slow down and stick to uranium-235 cause it to turn to uranium-236, which breaks apart rather quickly, creating more neutrons, a chain reaction. But neutrons in a light water nuclear reactor will not travel very far and get absorbed by water. So, in fact, to protect yourself from neutrons, it's actually good to be in a concrete bunker or in a swimming pool. Now, neutrons, because they're neutral and they don't have a normal quantum number, they can actually just travel through matter. So if I had a cup which could hold neutrons and that fall under the gravitational field and I pour them out of the cup onto your hand, they would actually just be emitting X-rays all the time as they decayed with that half-life, but they would just simply fall through your hand, through the table, through to Earth and go down to Earth until they hit water. They'd hit the water on you. And when they hit water, they emit water. This is the hydrogen in water, the main source of hydrogen. They will emit an X-ray. So we actually use that as a water detector. We just pour neutrons into the ground and wait for the X-rays, and it would go through you. And we use this property of neutrons just sticking to atoms to play around at the periodic table, move things to higher isotopes, they become unstable and change into new elements. And we slow it down. I'll tell a little story about Fermi's wooden table. This is his marble table and wooden table, how it all came to pass. But what we're talking about here is neutrons hitting normal water and eventually turning it into deuterated water. So what they tend to do is the water around a nuclear reactor will absorb neutrons and have more and more heavy water. In World War II, for instance, there was some Norwegian lakes or dams which had a higher amount of heavy water, and people began to try and extract it. The Germans tried to extract it that way, but a general easy way is just to have water around a nuclear reactor absorbing neutrons. These are things that you want to absorb. It is actually known that some really poorly built nuclear reactors had something called neutron shine. You could actually, the neutrons weren't absorbed, and you could actually detect them directly coming from the nuclear reactor. But a good nuclear reactor will absorb all its neutrons. Now, the Australian nuclear reactor, which is a very small Argentinian reactor, where the fuel is held in between aluminium plates. And so when it's finished, we just dissolve the aluminium away, and we've got the actual fuel, uranium pellets, but it's held in heavy water. And because the water has already absorbed all its neutrons, it no longer absorbs neutrons, and the actual neutrons can flow in this heavy water. And so if you have the water will absorb neutrons, it can absorb no more neutrons anymore. And at that stage, it will be D2O. So there was this little bottle of D2O back, probably 1985, and I wanted it to produce some isotopic mixes of water. So H2O, I wanted to produce HDO, and with a mixture of H2O, HDO, and D2O. And I was going to get some of that D2O, deuterated water, and just mix it with normal water and wait till I got the do some sort of chemical reaction with it to actually produce HDO. The reason I wanted to produce HDO is that I was trying to detect water in a mass spectrometer, and HDO is, there's no naturally occurring element with that particular molecular mass, so I could have very good signal to noise ratio when I was detecting it with a mass spectrometer. And so here we have it. We've got a beaker with about, say, 10 mil of pure water, and another beaker with 10 mils of D2O, and I put the two together. How could I mix it up such that it would produce 25% H2O, 50% HDO, and 25% D2O if I mix it all together? What could I do to do it? And the answer, the surprising answer, is that as the D2O even touches the H2O, the D2 and the deuterium and the protons mix instantaneously, almost faster than the speed of sound and water. It mixes that incredibly fast. And that's a bit strange, because that's the actual fact. That's something I saw instantly in my mass spectrometer. As soon as I put a drop of deuterium, deuterated water, in with my normal water, you could see HDO instantly. And that sort of was a bit of an earth-shattering moment for me, because at that point I realised that the chemical model that I had of a fixed H2O, that little boomerang-shaped molecule, and that moving around and vibrating in water, as you often see in all the textbooks or all the animations, it moves around and vibrates and moves around. So if you had labelled a H2O with a hydrogen and oxygen, and hydrogen for a particular water molecule, you'd come back half an hour later and that hydrogen would still be related to that oxygen, would still be related to that hydrogen. They'd be all linked together, because it was a molecule, a bit like a molecule of sugar or something else like that, or a molecule of methane. It would the hydrogens wouldn't mix and move, at least in the pictures, but obviously in the lab, this wasn't happening. The hydrogen was jumping in, on and off oxygens willy-nilly. So it was really an amazing thing. And still, when I look at water, it's an amazing thing. Water is a mixture of really atomic oxygen ions and hydrogen ions, and they're moving in and out from each other. So they just bounce around the entire, the hydrogen moves from one oxygen to the other, to the other, to the other, bounces around, and so to the deuterium it mixes around, and it mixes instantly. So the hydrogens are moving really quickly between different oxygens. So there's no such thing as a water molecule. Yeah, that's the most amazing thing. In a glass of water, there is no such thing as a distinct water molecule. That is a fiction. And that's that. Well, that for me was a profoundity. And what it is that a hydrogen bond is basically a hydrogen ion moving from one electron cloud to another. And so water has two hydrogens and two electron clouds, and so water can absorb a proton from another water, and as it does, it fires off its spare, it will have briefly three protons, and those, that next proton, a third proton, any one of those three will be fired off by it. So it's this amazing process that a hydrogen bond is just not a force, it's actually an exchange of hydrogens between two atoms. They can go, it goes back and forth between the two. Now, if you can imagine a card table with six players, and they all have a card, and what they do is they all pass one card to the left, the card will actually circulate very quickly in a circle. So they've got six cards, and they just pass the card to the left. And as they pass it to the left with their left hand, their right hand receives the next card. Okay, I don't know if you can see it. See that's a hydrogen bond. And it's the most amazing thing that hydrogens can zip in and out of molecules. Like the hydrogen bonds can zip up and down a DNA molecule. So the very center of our life, our life is made of DNA, and the very center strip of DNA, the zipper of our DNA, is all these twos and three hydrogen bonds. But it means that the hydrogen is jumping back and forth between the two DNA. There's, say, in the place of the DNA where there's three hydrogen bonds, there's two bases which pair together with three hydrogen bonds, two bases which pair together with two hydrogen bonds. But say in the three ones, there's three electron clouds and three hydrogens, and the hydrogens are zipping either side of those electron clouds. Now, in water, it's got this amazing process. The water is much closer to that player with, if you imagine, four arms, and they can accept a card from any of the two free arms, and with the arms which are holding a card, then pass on a card to another forearm player. That's the best way I can explain it. And so I had this undergraduate view of water as a fixed little boomerang, and the hydrogen's faithfully marrying the water forever and a day. But what's happened is that this is a real disco party. You have a glass of water, it's a disco party of oxygens and hydrogens, and the hydrogens are zipping around from oxygen to oxygen, and as it jumps onto one oxygen. That oxygen then spits out another hydrogen. And in a way, as it leaves, a whole series of hydrogens cascade to fill out the place where that hydrogen used to be. And the end result of it is you only really, you know, it could be two models. It could be that fixed models, i.e. like your molecular model set, where you have an oxygen and two hydrogens to make up one, make up another, and you get a whole box of standalone water molecules. And or you could have this other one, which you can't model, but the hydrogen's jumping between the oxygens the entire time. There's no way that you could tell the two, except if you could tag the neutrons as correction, tag the hydrogens, and you can also tag the oxygens, so you can O18. And it's when you do this that you see this fantastic a view of water, and it changes your understanding of water, why it sticks to each other, why water is so sticky, because it's water is hydrogen bonded to other water. That's what forms a drop, and that's why water climbs up walls so much. It's got this hydrogen bonds on steroids, and so water will, in actual fact, stick to the side of the capillary, and as it sticks to the side of the capillary, it will also stick to itself. And this means that it will actually start to ladder its way up. And this is seen in the trees around us. Our trees have small capillaries, and water at the roots is, by capillary action, lifted up to the top of the trees, where it evaporates. So the evaporation is transpiration, and that removes the water, which means that the water underneath sees a bit of dry leaf, the dried leaf, and it pulls and drags the next piece of water up. So as the leaf is dry, it's creating an energy for going forward. And there's a to lift it up. And there's a infrared picture of water being poured onto dry towel. And of course, what happens is that when the water hits the towel, water at room temperature hits the towel, it begins to evaporate and cool very much. But if you look at the infrared image, you can see that the very edge is quite hot, because the water is not evaporating, it's beginning to stick, and that sticking energy heats it up. It's that hydrogen bond release is a very interesting thing to see. And again, I talk to people, and they can see it cool down. They can't see the heat at the edge. And there's a whole lot of things that if you have that school model of the hydrogen wed to the oxygen for life, it's like a marriage, a long-term marriage. There's a whole lot of things that you don't see, understand, and appreciate. So I hope I've shared that with you as best as I can. And that's how a small bottle of deuterated water changed my life. In the meantime, keep on doing science.